50. I don't like being manipulated, Colonel. I'm inviting you to join the team. You should be excited, O.J. said, standing and crossing around to the opposite side of the desk, toward Zig. You know who you're reminding me of right now? In Karate Kid, the guy who runs the evil dojo? Sweep the leg? Cobra Kai. You've got his subtlety. They made a Netflix series where he comes back. As the hero of the story, the colonel said, I'm giving you an opportunity to actually be helpful. Can I just make one last point? The Netflix series is about Johnny, the student, not the sensei, who's still a douche face. Anyway, you were saying, you need a favor? It's about Roddy. Zig was listening. I know he reached out to you, Mr. Zigarowski. Zig sat there, not moving. Was O.J. bluffing? Didn't sound like it, which meant that the colonel had either been watching at the funeral or listening in on Zig's phone. Zig made a mental note, eyeing the big Hawaii photo on the ceiling. He's not your friend, Mr. Zigarowski, the colonel said, Zig now realizing that O.J. was one of those people who says your name over and over, hoping to create familiarity. An old military interrogation technique. I barely know Roddy. He's a stranger, Zig said. To us, too. We'd like to change that. Hence my offer. Next time you hear from him, we'd like to know. That's all we're asking, Mr. Zigarowski. Zig stayed silent, flushed with that feeling he'd get when a family member would say that their dead relative was a real character. They were trying to keep things nice, but there was clearly so much more they weren't saying. And this'll help you track down Nola? Zig asked. This has nothing to do with... I'm not a fool, sir. I know you're looking for her. I know that when you tried to bring her in, one of your crew got a pen jabbed into his kneecap. And don't tell me he's not part of your crew, because it's not hard to recognize hands grabbing lightning bolts, Zig said, motioning over to the colonel's credenza and the row of flight helmets. Semper Vigilis, Colonel. Latin for why don't you stop bullshitting me and tell me the truth? Leaning on the front corner of his desk, Colonel Whatley stared down at his staple remover, closing it in slow motion. Mr. Zigarowski, call me Zig. Mr. Zigarowski, do you really even know Nola Brown? Why do I feel like you're about to make a speech? She grew up in your hometown, didn't she? I also saw she was in the same Girl Scout troop as your daughter. That's some real history you share. She saved my life. I read about that. But back when Nola first joined the military, do you truly know what she was like? Or to put it more succinctly, when no one's looking, do you know what she's capable of? I know about Grandma's pantry. No, you don't. If you did, you wouldn't be here sniffing around. Then tell me about it, Zig demanded. You keep acting like this is a negotiation. You have no idea what... In World War II, your unit did specialized investigations. Is that what this is about? Some old investigation that Nola found out about? O.J. rolled his eyes, his thumb rubbing at a wedding band that was no longer there. Lord Almighty. Do you even realize what a pain in the rear you are, Mr. Zigarowski? Stop thinking you're in a position to make demands. Then stop thinking you're getting my help, because last I checked, you're the one who needs the favor from me, Zig said, standing from his seat and heading for the door. Where are you going? O.J. asked. Zig kept walking, picking up speed. Mr. Zigarowski, if you don't sit down, you keep acting like this is a negotiation. Have fun solving this yourself, he said as he was about to leave. It's for the end of the world, O.J. said. The what? Zig asked, stopping at the threshold. Grandma's pantry. That's what it was designed for, O.J. said, stealing a glance at the ceiling tile, at the calming photo of the Hawaiian Ocean palms, the purple lei, and the coconut drink. It's where the government prepares for the end of the world. 51. Fairwinds, Pennsylvania.
Oh, Mrs. Z, it's been... How are you?
Well, really well, Charmaine replied, saying it twice as if that had helped her believe it. Her phone was flat on her kitchen table, on speaker so she could nurse her morning coffee. Outside, she eyed the bird feeder that Warren put in all his model homes, filled with safflower seeds, since squirrels tended to hate them. Yet there was a squirrel, feasting on them anyway. When my mom said you'd call, Dara stopped herself, overcome with excitement.
Oh, Mrs. Z,
Charmaine, you can call me Charmaine.
I can't. I'd never. How long's it been?
Dara asked, her intonation rising at the end of her sentences. Up talk. Older generations label it as flakiness or an insecurity. But as Charmaine knew, language is supposed to change. It's no different than fashion. Why do people wear skinny jeans? It signals you're part of a group. Kids don't listen to the same music as their parents or wear their hair the same way. Like it or not, it's a good sign. Proof that, as a culture, we're moving forward. And as people, we're getting older. Your mom said you're starting your last year of law school. That's wonderful, Charmaine added, feeling a twist in her belly that reminded her of those first years after Maggie died, when she'd go to supermarkets two towns over to avoid seeing anyone she knew.
Insane, right? First semester ends right before my due date.
Charmaine froze, nearly spilling her coffee. There was no breath left in her body.
Mom didn't tell you? Dara asked. Mrs. Z, I'm sorry. I didn't...
It's fine. I'm thrilled for you.
You know, I'd never...
Dara, please. We're good. That's a blessing. It should be celebrated, Charmaine said, blinking over and over, kicking herself for not seeing it coming. Like any parent who's buried a child, Charmaine had become a connoisseur at avoiding subjects she knew would slice her in the underbelly. Staring out at the squirrel who was still munching away, she felt the knife continue to twist.
I appreciate you saying that, Mrs. Z. You and Mr. Z. You were always... Anywho, tell me how I can help.
Something with superstars, my mom said.
That place was therapy fuel for my entire adolescence.
It didn't take long to explain the rest. The old video of Maggie crying, and that from the looks of the tape, she was clearly crying to someone who couldn't be seen on screen.
Dara, if you know who that might be, if you have any ideas, I'd owe you forever.
There was a pause, but not a long one.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Z. I really am, Dara said. But the honest truth is, if Maggie was crying in the studio, or even her being at the studio, I've got no memory of it.
52. When you say end of the world, I mean the actual end of the world. Or at least the end when it came to the Cold War, O.J. began, still sitting on the front edge of his desk, motioning Zig to take a seat. Zig waved him off, preferring to stand. If it annoyed the colonel, he wasn't showing it. He was too busy glancing to his left at his window. Zig followed his gaze outside, realizing O.J.'s office overlooked the small lot on the side of the building that Dover used as a side entrance to help the families of victims who needed a bit more privacy. O.J.'s glance lingered a second too long, and now Zig couldn't tell if the colonel was trying to make sure they were alone, or looking for someone who was coming.
You were saying about the Cold War? Zig asked.
I was saying this was back in the 1950s when... Well, he turned back to Zig. Guess what America was building faster than anyone back then? Why do you keep asking questions I can't possibly know the answer to?
Humor me, Mr. Zigarowski.
It's 1954. President Eisenhower is at the top of his game and is rightfully convinced that Russia is building an arsenal of missiles that they're determined to bomb us with. So what do we start building in return?
More missiles to bomb them.
Correct.
But here's the rub. Eisenhower's a military man. He knows we need a good offense. But he's also savvy enough to know we need a good defense. That's a wonderful history lesson, but what's this have to do with NOLA or Grandma's pant? This is the context, O.J. said, stealing another quick glance outside. Side entrance still clear. In 1949, 6 years after the Pentagon first opened, they realized that a surprise Russian attack could easily take out all of Washington, D.C. So military higher-ups decided that their top priority was to build a backup command center somewhere outside D.C., in case they needed to keep the government running. It started in Adams County, just over the Pennsylvania line from Maryland, where Uncle Sam quietly started buying land like they were Walt Disney himself. From there, they started digging. And on June 30th, 1953, 7 months after Eisenhower was elected, the government opened, "I know about Raven Rock and Mount Weather," Zig said, referring to the government's two most secret military bunkers, one underground, one in a mountaintop, that were still in use today, including on 9/11 when Dick Cheney and other top officials were evacuated there. "I've buried fallen from both." "Then you also know that both bunkers are solely for government honchos and military employees. That's a fraction of the picture. What happens to everyone else? The millions of U.S. citizens around the country, when the bombs fall, who takes care of them?" Swaying there a moment, Zig stayed quiet, noticing a gray Buick pull into the parking lot. "It's a potent question," O.J. added, both of them now eyeing the Buick as its door swung open and a middle-aged woman with hip cat-eye glasses got out. Edna from Veterans Affairs. No one to worry about, though the way O.J. was turned toward the window, Zig noticed a small sweat stain in the armpit of his flight suit. Whoever he was waiting for, this wasn't a friendly visit. In 1954, to find the answer, O.J. explained, the organization that specialized in keeping civilians safe, the FCDA, Federal Civil Defense Administration, was moved out of Washington and into an old sanitarium in Battle Creek, Michigan. And this is real? Look it up. The goal of the FCDA was crystal clear. Civilian defense during an atomic disaster, which they quickly narrowed to three possibilities. Dispersal, evacuation, or shelter. Or as they put it, dig, die, or get out. And come on. You really think anyone wants to die? O.J. asked, turning back to Zig and pushing his glasses up on his nose. I still don't see what this has to do with Grandma's This is where it was born. Mount Weather was codenamed High Point. This Michigan sanitarium was called Low Point, a place where the government would consider every different invention and scenario to protect civilians if a hydrogen bomb hit. 200-bed pop-up hospitals that could fit inside a tractor trailer and be driven to a radiated area within 4 hours of an attack. Collection teams that would mobilize to ID all the bodies. They even came up with an emergency plan to move the dead. 7,000 post office trucks that, instead of carrying mail, would carry corpses. Upbeat place to work. You do realize we're now standing in a mortuary? O.J. asked, still locked on Zig. The point, he continued, was that by 1955, the best ideas were turned into actual exhibits, sent to tour around the country and to state fairs. And people enjoyed that. In 1955, people loved it. Atomic fever and bunker building were in full swing, especially when it came to one of the most popular campaigns. Named? O.J. paused. Is this where you want me to say Grandma's Pantry? Grandma's Pantry, O.J. said. A campaign that urged families to stockpile enough food and water to last 7 days. Even had its own slogan. Grandma was always ready for an emergency. Catchy. You have no idea. It became so popular, Sears started putting Grandma's Pantry displays in stores around the country, encouraging people to buy supplies and food to save their families. As the Cold War escalated, billions were poured into civilian shelters, massive stockpiles were built, and the continuity of government movement was born, focusing around every doomsday scenario imaginable, especially as the FCDA evolved to FEMA, then got folded into Homeland Security. But at the heart of it all was this simple truth. None of it would work. None of it, O.J. agreed, stealing another glance outside. If a war began and a nuclear bomb really hit U.S. soil, top officials might make it to a shelter, but the rest of us would be leveled. So that was the end of Grandma's Pantry? It was. Until the late 1990s, when a government employee named Stephen Bice wrote a paper recommending that a new stockpile be started, a new Grandma's Pantry, so to speak. But his theory was that instead of focusing on canned goods, this one should focus on pharmaceuticals. According to Bice's paper, the threat to America had changed. Nuclear missiles weren't the threat anymore. Bioterrorism was. He's right, Zig said, still remembering the antibiotics and chemical bath he was forced to take when the body of a 32-year-old female State Department employee came through Dover, and they realized she was killed in a ricin attack. He was absolutely right, O.J. agreed. And the amazing part is, for once, the government actually listened. Embracing Bice's idea, Uncle Sam opened a vaccine and bioterror stockpile in 1999. Grandma's Pantry 2.0, Zig said, quickly doing the math. Just in time for a year and a half later, 9/11 happens. Then come the anthrax attacks. For both, the newly named Strategic National Stockpile, the SNS, was ready, shipping push packages with anthrax vaccines that saved potentially hundreds of thousands of lives. And in the aftermath of 9/11, it set off the biggest spending spree for national defense since the days of Eisenhower himself, Zig said, well aware that that's when the Dover mortuary was upgraded, moving into its current multi-million-dollar building. With new threats and new wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, Uncle Sam needed new facilities to handle the dead. Mr. Zigarowski, I know words like secret government warehouse sound like something from the end of Indiana Jones, but it's real. Today there are 11 undisclosed warehouses carefully hidden across the country, O.J. said, with a new tone in his voice, one Zig had never heard before. Each one is filled with vaccines for smallpox, SARS, hantavirus, you name it. That's who handled Ebola in 2014, and Zika in 2016, and who would have been storing all the COVID-19 vaccines had they existed before the pandemic. Whatever health disaster hits, toxic attacks, viral attacks, chemical weapons, they've got antidotes, antivirals, surgical equipment, sedatives. Where do you think half the COVID ventilators came from? Hell, they store cobra venom for whatever the hell that does. And I'm not even making it up. Thanks to Mr. Bice's paper, they can get you the meds you need within an hour for well-populated areas, a maximum of 5 hours for the most rural locations, O.J. said, glancing up for a half second at the Hawaiian paradise in the ceiling. From its angle diagonally above O.J.'s desk, it made Zig wonder if instead of being there to calm visitors, the Hawaiian ceiling tiles were actually there for O.J.'s benefit. I appreciate the context, Colonel. But can we please get to the part you're obviously leaving out? Pardon? I worked here on 9/11, Zig said. When those first anthrax victims were sent our way, I still remember the plastic smell inside the oxygen suits they trained us in. And you know who did that training? The CDC. The Centers for Disease Control. I know the acronym. Then you should also know they trained us for Ebola, SARS, smallpox, and even that nerve agent that killed one of our spies in Saudi Arabia a few years back. It was always the CDC, working with Homeland Security, FBI, CIA, even the DIA. but never once did they call in a top-secret army unit whose specialty was clandestine investigations. For the first time since Zig stepped into the office, OJ didn't say a word. It goes back to that night, doesn't it, Colonel? 5 years ago, your crew got the call to go to one of those secret grandma's pantry warehouses. Something happened there, didn't it? Something more than just some missing post-it notes from the supply closet.
There was a break-in, OJ said.
What?
A break-in. 5 years ago. That's what started all this. We had a break-in at Grandma's pantry.
53. So, like a robbery?
That's not what I said, OJ replied.
Zig knew that tone. He replayed the facts. All those vaccines in one place. The smallpox alone. If a terrorist got their hands on that, what did they get?
They didn't get anything.
So you stopped them? Or did someone...
Zig caught himself, almost forgetting the real reason he was here. Nola.
This goes back to Nola, doesn't it? She was there that night, too.
Mr. Zigarowski, can you please stop repeating my damn name? Then can you please shut your mouth and listen for once? Nola's job, as artist in residence, do you even know what it was?
She did paintings for the army.
No, OJ said, using the word like a blade. She did paintings of disasters. That's why Nola came to Grandma's pantry. To bear witness, to see up close the shitstorm Mint and his crew were dealing with.
His crew.
Zig made a mental note. From the sound of it, OJ wasn't there that night. What matters is, when the break-in happened, Mint was the one who got the call, OJ explained. His team was first on scene. Nola came a few hours after, but you can imagine what she was walking into. Everyone scrambling, people yelling at each other. And that's the thing about stressful situations. They'll make you do things you'd never do otherwise, OJ said, letting the statement hang in the air.
Colonel, I know you're amping up the drama to impress me, but I have no idea what you're getting at.
I thought you said the thieves didn't get anything.
No, I said the people who broke in didn't get anything.
But someone did.
And that's...
You're saying Nola stole something that night?
OJ didn't answer.
One of the bioterror samples? Or
Mr. Zigarowski, you asked me what happened. I told you. 5 years ago, on a night everyone would rather forget, we had a break-in at Grandma's pantry. The thieves were caught. Yet what they were targeting still somehow walked away.
But to blame Nola... Can you even prove?
Prove?
Here's what I know. Mint was there that night, and he's dead. Rashida was there, and she's dead. And when it all went down 5 years ago, well, considering that artists in residence get to choose the different disasters they want to paint, it seemed pretty damn convenient that of all the places Nola could have painted that night, she picked Grandma's pantry. So asking her to now come in for a sit-down seems like a pretty reasonable request, even if it's just to understand the sudden reappearance of her brother.
Zig froze.
I told you. We know you've been talking to Roddy, OJ added. I'd like to know what he said.
He's looking for Nola. I'm doing the same.
So this is all just coincidence. Roddy shows up. And suddenly Nola's past is back to haunt her?
Mr. Zigarowski, I asked your former co-workers here about you. They said you were a stubborn man, a loyal man, and definitely a lonely man, but not a naive one.
Zig rolled his eyes. Do you even realize how much bad dialogue you stole from Law and Order? You're the one who brought me in. You asked for my help. So until you have proof that Roddy found this old secret about his sister, you keep acting like this is your investigation.
It's not, OJ insisted. my old unit. Our specialty was the problems that Uncle Sam preferred to keep off the front page, and making sure that every loose end got properly buried. But it's the one truth every mortician knows. Just because you bury something doesn't mean it goes away. Listen. No, you listen. I have two soldiers who were murdered, one of whom I knew so long I wouldn't be sitting here today without him. I owe his wife. I owe his children. And I intend to repay that debt, Mr. Zagorowski. I'm telling you how to help me. So if you hear from Nola, you keep saying it's her. But for all you know, Mint and Rashida were the ones who took your stolen item. Maybe that's why they were killed. Someone finally figured out it was them. A swell of rage took OJ's face, his clenched jaw about to open. It reminded Zig of the way his father used to yell, exploding with a roar. To Zig's surprise, though, as quick as the wave of rage hit, it disappeared. OJ staring straight up and taking another long visual drink of the Hawaiian Ocean palms, the coconut cocktail, and the purple lei. Mr. Zagorowski, in the military, do you know what the single best skill is to rise in the ranks? I'd take a guess, but you're about to tell me. The ability to tell the difference between what you can change versus what's inevitable, OJ said, his chin in the air, still focused intently on the Hawaiian palms. It's where you're currently failing. Now Zig was staring up at the Hawaiian photo. You think she'll come around, but she won't, Mr. Zagorowski. That's how Nola is. It's how she always is. You can give her all your attention. You can take a bullet to keep her safe. You can find the truth, catch Mint's killers, exonerate her in every way. But you'll still never be part of her life. That's not why I'm doing this. Keep telling yourself that, OJ shot back. We all need what we need. I know her a long time. Every Nola story has the same ending. When the smoke clears and the blood's being mopped from the floor, you're gonna put your hand up for that high five, and she's gonna slip out a side door and get as far away from you as humanly possible. It's what she does. Inevitable. Outside in the parking lot, a black Chevy Suburban pulled in near the side entrance. Zig didn't notice. He was still eyeing the ceiling's Hawaiian paradise, wondering what photo he'd choose if he needed to bring himself some calm. Nothing came to mind. Mr. Zagorowski, if Nola or Roddy contact you again. Zig's phone started ringing. Caller ID told him the rest. Tell me that's Nola, and I'll believe the universe is fair, OJ said. It's not. But I need you to know I'm not working against you, Colonel. If I hear from either of them, I'll let you know. I have your word on that? The phone rang again. Zig headed for the door. Sorry, Colonel, I really need to take this. OJ yelled something else, but Zig was already racing up the main hallway toward the wishing well, still trying to think of a photo that brought him calm. Ziggy, you there? A familiar voice announced in his ear. It was his assistant at the funeral home, Puerto Rican Andy. I made the calls, Andy said as Zig ran out the front door into the main lot. You need to get back here. I spoke to Superstars, the modeling place. She gave me a name, Andy. How about putting together a complete sentence? You need to see this. I found someone, an old employee. It's bad, Ziggy. He knew your daughter. 54. St. Anthony's Medical Center, Elkton, Maryland. So you remember her? With hair like that? Asked a very pregnant nurse named Sandy as she pointed at the photo of Nola. She wasn't exactly a talker. Sandy had a square face, long fingernails with tiny rhinestones, and a necklace with a gold charm for each of her three children, all boys. Plus, we don't get many visitors around here, Sandy explained as they walked down the hallway and she motioned to the other rooms they passed. Wags nodded, eyeing the patients through the open doors, every one frozen in bed, their mouths agape, their hands clenched, their legs curled in ways that legs weren't meant to curl. In the previous hospital, Mrs. Silvestri looked bad. These patients looked worse. "You get used to it," Nurse Sandy said, reading Wags's mind. From her years at Dover, Wags knew it was true. It was the best and worst feature of the human brain. You can normalize anything. So when Nola showed up here, she said she was a friend of Mr. Sewell, asked for him by name, did a little painting of him. "I thought it was sweet," Nurse Sandy explained as Wags made a mental note. If Nola was painting him, she was looking for something. "And you didn't think it was odd having someone just show up?" "Like I said, it was sweet. No one had visited him in 14 years. 14? "Our specialty is long-term care, emphasis on the lung. We've got one patient. She's been here nearly 30 years. Truth is, we were just happy Mr. Sewell had some company. When it comes to the coma ward, people aren't exactly banging down the coma. Another brain injury." "I'm not sure what you mean by another, but you do realize that's our specialty here. Traumatic brain injuries." Wags nodded, glancing around. "That's why the hall was so silent." "Do you happen to know how Mr. Sewell got injured?" Wags asked, her voice picking up speed. "Not that he's been here so long, I actually don't. What about Nola? When she came to visit, any idea what she was looking for?" "You should ask him," Sandy said. "Excuse me?" The nurse pointed to room 141, the open door on their left. "I thought that's why you were here," she explained. "Mr. Sewell, he's been awake for a few weeks now. You can ask him yourself." 55. In 10 minutes, the blood would be everywhere. But for now, the sun was in Zig's eyes as he gripped the phone in his fist. "Come on," Zig muttered. "Pick up the damn—" "It's me," Wags's recorded voice said. "No one answers their phone anymore. Send me a text if it's important." Beep. Zig hung up with one hand, holding the steering wheel with the other. The ride from Dover wasn't long, a quick half hour, and he'd tried Wags half a dozen times. Sent texts, too. No response. It wasn't a shock. At the Bureau, Wags was always getting called onto other cases. Still, every few minutes, Zig glanced down at his texts. "Not funny, Wags. Where are you?" He wanted to talk things through, and after his visit with the head of Dover, he needed her tech help, too. According to Colonel Watley, all those years ago at Grandma's pantry, something bad went down. A break-in. A disaster, he called it, which is why Nola came to paint it in the first place. From what OJ said, the people who broke in didn't get anything. But someone did. "Okay, Nola. What would make you steal something?" Zig wondered, thinking of Nola's history of disagreements with her superiors. "Something that pissed you off? Or maybe something illegal that you saw someone else stealing?" To Zig, it didn't make sense. Nola wasn't a thief. Though on that night, someone clearly was. So what's worth stealing? That was the question, he realized, replaying OJ's description of the Grandma's Pantry warehouses. Antidotes, vaccines. All the germ warfare vials would be worth millions on the black market. OJ also mentioned sedatives, which 5 years ago, that was the height of the opioid crisis. Grandma's Pantry would have had enough doses to cover a city. If someone tried stealing that. Zig rolled it again through his brain. As theories go, both made sense, but the one loose thread that kept sticking out from the sweater was OJ himself. Dover's wing commander wasn't just a passive bystander. He used to be in the same investigative unit as both victims, Mint and Rashida. A unit like that would have tons of resources to call on. So would Dover. But instead of calling in those resources, OJ brought in Zig.
Was OJ being smart or just desperate? Either way, he was breaking protocol. Zig wasn't sure what it meant, but he did know this. For OJ, something about this case was touching a nerve. The colonel was rattled. This whole thing somehow personal. On top of that, according to Mint's wife, it seemed pretty clear that Mint and Rashida had had an affair. Did Nola know that back when they were at Grandma's pantry? And far more important, what was Mint doing with a second, apparently secret phone? It made Zig think of the third name on the back of Nola's painting, Elijah King. According to the logbook, OJ was trying to track him down. No response. Time for Zig to reach out as well. Following the curve of Route 1 past the fire station, Zig again glanced down at his own phone in the car's cup holder. Still no word from Wags, who was the only person with enough security clearance to get a look at whatever old files might still exist from Grandma's pantry. Zig's phone vibrated with a shudder. A text from Puerto Rican Andy. "You far?" Andy asked. 2 minutes, Zig typed back, trying to refocus. Earlier, Andy had tracked down someone at Superstars Modeling, someone who knew Zig's daughter. "It's bad, Ziggy. Get back here. Now." Zig bit the skin on the inside of his lip. With a tug of the steering wheel, he skidded into the parking lot of Kalta's funeral home. But as he parked in his usual spot on the side of the building, something caught his eye. The red light. A single bulb above the employee entrance. Decades ago, during a private viewing, one of the flower delivery guys had barged through the side entrance, practically crashing into an elderly mother saying goodbye to her middle-aged son. The next day, the red light bulb was installed, an unsubtle signal that when lit meant stop, client inside, come around front. Zig got out of the car and headed for the front door, already confused. Mrs. Paoli was buried 2 days ago. Did someone new come in? If they did, Andy would usually say something. Yet as Zig turned the corner and reached the front parking lot, dead empty. Not a single car in sight. He looked around the side. Puerto Rican Andy's white van was where it always was, next to Zig's car. No other vehicles. So whoever was inside, they walked here? Zig glanced at Route 1, where a scattering of cars blew past, quickly disappearing. This was a commercial district. No one walked here. Zig looked back at the funeral home, at the red light. His arms felt heavy, his skin like a fraying rag. Sometimes in life there seemed to be an invisible rope pulling you toward something, and other times it seemed abundantly clear you're supposed to stay away. Was Zig being paranoid? Maybe. Yet as he headed for the front door of what used to be a Dairy Queen, he reached into his pocket and gripped his knife, a SOG Trident Elite. It was a gift from the spouse of a fallen Navy SEAL, who modified the blade with a deep groove at the top so it could be opened as it was pulled out. The groove also did extra damage, adding a puncture to every slice. There was a soft, almost imperceptible magnetic click as Zig opened the door. The funeral home's notification system, which sent an entry alert to both Zig's office and the embalming room in back. "Who's hungry for munchkins?" Zig sang out, using Puerto Rican Andy's favorite line from his daily Dunkin' Donuts run. No answer. On his right was a dark wood podium that usually held the sign-in book. Beyond that was a closed door to the room that displayed the different types of coffins. In nearly every funeral home in America, the biggest coffin manufacturers will sell to you only if you display the cheapest coffins in front, the most expensive in back, so that by the time a family sees the good stuff, they'll be cornered and easier to close. When Zig took over, he told those companies that their services would no longer be needed. "What about Quidditch? Anyone want to play Quidditch?" Zig added, trying to get a response. Still nothing. Zig looked up at the in-ceiling speakers. On days when there wasn't a funeral, they played soft piano music. Currently, the music was off. "Andy, you okay?"
No response. Zig's skin felt brittle, like it was starting to tear. Regripping the knife in his pocket, he headed slowly, carefully toward the main viewing area. "Andy, I'm dialing 911 right now," Zig shouted, entering a wide room with rows of empty pews and dark burgundy carpet. "So if this is like that time when you were pretending to be Voldemort in the final movie, we'll—" 50 points from Griffin.
"Mr. Zigarowski, I'm trying to save you from an awful day, so I'm asking this once. Your knife, put it where I can see it. Please," a female voice announced.
Zig spun toward the front corner of the room, toward an open door that led to a foyer for private family viewing.
"Ziggy, I'm
sorry," Puerto Rican Andy whimpered, his lip bleeding, his right eye swollen shut.
She asked if you were carrying. If I didn't tell them, or say that stuff about Maggie."
Andy coughed like he was choking. Behind Andy, a red-headed woman with piercing, different-colored eyes pulled a string she held to Andy's throat.
No, not a string. A thin metal saw. "The knife, Mr. Zigarowski. I know it's in your pocket," Reagan said.
56. The woman was tall, nearly as tall as Puerto Rican Andy, which was saying something.
"Let him go," Zig demanded. "I don't think you're hearing me, Mr. Zigarowski," Reagan said. "The knife."
"I don't think you're hearing me," Zig said, hand still in his pocket. "Let him—"
"I'm slitting his throat now," Reagan said, starting to tug.
Wait, no. My knife, here. Here," Zig said, pulling out his knife and tossing it on the floor where it cartwheeled across the carpet.
That was all they needed.
In a blur, something moved behind Zig, someone who was hiding by the old ice cream drive-through window that had been reframed into an alcove with a hanging American flag. Before Zig knew what hit him, a tree trunk-sized arm wrapped around his neck, squeezing him in a brutal chokehold.
"Stupid old man," Zig thought, cursing himself for not seeing it coming. The attack on Andy. It was just a distraction.
Zig tried to turn, tried to fight. He didn't have a chance. His attacker was massive, a huge Irish redhead as big as a building, moving with a speed his size shouldn't allow. He hit Zig like a tornado, hooking his arm around Zig's throat and pinching Zig's neck in the crook of his elbow. Zig gasped for air. Nothing came. He was choking, his face bright red, barely able to breathe.
"Let's try this again, Mr. Zigarowski. I'm trying to save you from an awful day," the red-headed woman repeated. "It's a rather simple question. Tell us what you know about Black House."
57. Zig's head was about to pop. Blood flushed his face. He was fighting for air, trying to say something.
"Seabass, I think we all get the point," the red-headed woman called out. The big man, Seabass, rolled his eyes. "Really? Like I'm some kind of novice?"
He eased up on his chokehold. Zig gasped, starting to cough.
"I don't like funeral homes, Mr. Zigarowski. They bring back a bad memory for me about my sister," the woman added. "So whatever you know about Black House—"
"I never—"
Zig was still coughing, Seabass's forearm still at his throat.
"I don't know Black House. Never heard of it."
The woman's gaze slid sideways to Puerto Rican Andy. She gritted her teeth, tugging on the saw at his neck.
"Ziggy, please,"
Andy begged. Snot, tears, and blood poured from his nose and lips.
"Wait. That place. Black House,"
Zig said, hoping to buy time.
"I can help you. Maybe I know it by another name. Tell me more about it."
"You're trying to stall," Reagan said. She was smart. Posture like a flagpole. Military for sure.
The most unnerving part was her voice. As Zig had learned from years of reading Dover casualty reports, when a soldier panics or is about to do something desperate, they usually take suicide breaths, quick huffs to psych themselves up. Reagan was a flatline. If anything, she had a twinkle of larceny in her eyes.
Andy, you okay? Zig asked, purposely saying his name.
Keep him human and you'll keep him alive.
Andy nodded. The thin saw a black line across his larynx.
Ma'am,
I know you don't know me, but I'm a man of my word, Zig said. He was up on his tiptoes, still in a chokehold, his chin raised like he was standing in the deep end of a pool and trying to keep his mouth above water.
What I said about blackouts. Let me help you. At the very least, trade me for him. Let him go. I can help you.
The woman didn't answer. She turned toward her partner.
Seabass?
She asked.
It was a bad sign.
If she was using Seabass's name, she'd already made her decision. Zig and Andy weren't walking out of here.
Ziggy, my kid,
Andy called out. You're gonna be fine. I got what they want, Zig insisted.
Ma'am, listen to me, he added, locking on Reagan. This place, Black House, it's obviously a code name, yes?
The two redheads exchanged another glance, then another, having an entire conversation in silence like an old married couple.
Or brother and sister.
Seabass shook his head.
Don't fall for his crap. He doesn't know shite.
Okay, so if it's a code name, talk to me about it, Zig added. Maybe I know it through someone else.
Seabass shot another look at Reagan.
Don't let him fool you.
It's a location.
Online, Reagan said as Seabass rolled his eyes again.
Like a website? Zig asked.
Like a place where people want to talk. Privately.
Zig glanced around at the empty pews, mentally running through the details from his Dover visit with...
Oh, crap.
Colonel Mint. That's who was talking privately, wasn't it?
Reagan stayed silent, the knuckles on her middle fingers now white from gripping the camping saw at Andy's neck.
Make your point, Mr. Zigarowski.
When I was at Dover, there's another phone. Mint's wife,
Zig took a breath.
He had a second cell phone. From what I can tell, they're still going through it.
Reagan stared at Zig.
Anything else? She asked.
I'm trying to help you get what you want. If someone was having a private talk with Colonel Mint, or trying to meet up with him, I don't know. Maybe this Black House place. You sure it's not part of Grandma's pantry?
Reagan cocked her head, confused.
What's Grandma's pan?
The blood hit Zig first, a hot spray across the back of his neck. The world slowed to a halt as Seabass started to turn. His chokehold loosened, though just slightly. Zig was still focused on the back of his own neck, thinking someone had spit at him. Seabass continued to turn. No, not turn. He was off balance, falling. He smacked himself in the face, like he was swatting a mosquito on his cheek. There was no mosquito, just a small dark hole at the center of his cheek, charred at the edges. Instinctively, Seabass stuck his fingertip inside it, looking mad, annoyed even, the pain still not registering. Then he tasted the blood. It was nowhere, then everywhere, pouring from Seabass's mouth. He tipped sideways, like a drunk who'd lost his battle with gravity. Zig was still in mid-turn as Seabass began to tumble.
To Zig, it made no sense. All that blood, and the hole. Then it hit him like a fist. Shot.
Someone shot Seabass in the face.
Zig, at your nine. Get low,
someone yelled. Zig turned to his left, still barely registering the words.
He knew that voice.
A shadow turned the corner.
Roddy.
58. Roddy ran straight at Zig, raising his gun.
Get low! Get low!
Roddy shouted, aiming his pistol. It was the tactical 45 with the silencer. Two more shots. Zig was still in mid-turn, his first thought simply that, as Roddy turned the corner, it looked comical,
the way he was perfectly framed by the old ice cream drive-through window behind him.
Seabass was bent over, holding his cheek, spitting blood and teeth. He'd been shot in the face.
You crazy motherf-.
Like an NFL lineman, Roddy plowed into Seabass, both of them tumbling toward the pews, crashing to the carpet. Roddy was half his size, but momentum was on his side. So was his police training. They hit the carpet with a thud, Roddy using his forearm like a nightstick, pinning it to Seabass's throat, squeezing the air out of him.
Roddy saved me, Zig thought, still wobbling as he tried to find his footing. Barely 5 seconds had passed since Roddy raced into the room. Zig was still trying to process how these redheads surprised him and...
No, not just him.
Ziggy, run!
Puerto Rican Andy screamed.
Oh, God. He almost forgot. The metal saw. Andy! Don't!
Zig yelled, spinning toward his friend.
Too late. With a ruthless tug, Reagan yanked the thin metal camping saw at Andy's neck. Andy tried to grab it. He didn't have a chance.
Andy!
Zig screamed.
A thin red line appeared across Andy's throat, like a crimson smile. His hands bled too, his palms facing out, the saw digging into them.
Zig was already running down the center aisle of the sanctuary, plowing straight at them, straight at her. He didn't have a plan. Just get there. Get to him.
Let him go, Zig yelled.
To his surprise, Reagan did exactly that. She wasn't letting Zig tackle them. Like any pro, her first priority was self-preservation. Lifting her foot to Andy's back, Reagan kicked him straight at Zig. Her left hand let go of the saw, but her right one held tight to it.
So as Andy flew forward, momentum took care of the rest, spinning him like a top. The saw bit into his throat, slicing even deeper.
Andy gasped, stumbling, his legs buckling.
I got you. I'm here,
Zig insisted, catching him mid-fall.
Andy was dead weight. He hit like a boulder, blood waterfalling down his neck, down his shirt. It was everywhere.
No. No, no, no.
Zig dropped to his knees, lowering Andy to the floor. Out of the corner of his eye, Zig spotted Reagan running up the far right aisle, toward the back of the sanctuary. Zig could catch her or save Andy.
It wasn't a choice.
Andy wheezed, gasping for air. Nothing came out. His eyes were wide, dancing back and forth, pleading for help, already in shock.
The good news is, she missed Fox, Zig said, staring down at the phoenix tattoo on Andy's neck.
You're gonna be okay, he added, though he knew it was a lie. Tiny air bubbles gurgled from Andy's throat.
Bad sign. She'd sliced his trachea. Roddy! I need you,
Zig shouted, clamping his hands on Andy's throat to stop the bleeding. Past the last pew, Roddy sat on Seabass's chest, burying a punch into the big redhead's face. Seabass tried fighting back, raising his arm. Roddy hit him again, then again, Seabass finally going limp, unconscious. It didn't slow Roddy down. He unloaded with another punch, then another, the ferocity catching Zig off guard. Spit flew from Roddy's lips. Then a strand of drool dangled down. A plump vein swelled at his temple, his punches getting faster.
Roddy, get over here! He's gonna bleed out!
Roddy was just a blur now, slamming his fist into Seabass's face, then winding up and doing it over and over, pile driver after pile driver, each impact a sickening wet crunch of meat and bone. With each hit, Roddy let out the kind of grunt you'd hear during sex. Zig called his name again, begging for help. Still no response. As Roddy cocked his fist back for another hit, there was blood on his knuckles. Zig now realizing that with each punch, Roddy had been targeting the bullet wound in Seabass's cheek. Just like Nola, feasting on the weak spots. As Roddy unleashed another vicious punch, a stray spatter of blood bit his cheek. If Roddy felt it, he didn't care, his plump veins swelling thicker than ever.
Roddy, get off him! My friend's gonna fucking die!
Roddy turned at the outburst,
Come on. He's about to pass out, Zig added as Roddy started to run, sliding next to him, down on his knees, eyes wide with concern, specks of blood on his face. Andy's eyes were glazed, his skin starting to turn gray. He was losing too much blood, his breathing barely audible. Roddy, I need you Zig didn't have to finish. Zig let go of Andy's throat, and Roddy clamped his hands in place. Basic triage. Cover the windpipe, but don't crush it. Most important, stop the bleeding. The problem was, the blood was still flowing, seeping between Roddy's fingers. Mr. Zig, if she nicked his trachea, don't say it. You don't know that, Zig shouted, reaching to his left and grabbing a pew cushion from the front row. Something absorbent. Frantically tearing open the cushion, he pulled out its foam stuffing, tossing it to Roddy. Roddy stuffed the foam into place, but the blood was still coming. Andy's eyes rolled sideways. Red air bubbles seeped from the wound. Blood was in his airway. On his phone, Zig dialed 911. His wound. It looks terrible, Roddy said in his usual flat tone. They won't make it in time. Use the foam! You're not listening. Blood is filling his lungs. Use the damn foam, Zig yelled, darting to the front of the sanctuary, toward the open door in the corner. As he ran, he told the 911 operator to send an ambulance to Calta's funeral home. But Roddy was right. They wouldn't make it in time. Zig picked up his pace, ramming the door with his shoulder and plowing down a narrow hallway to a room at the back of the building. Danger. Hazardous materials. The smell was proof of that. As Zig burst inside, on his left, up on a dolly, was a Rubbermaid trash can filled with powdered formaldehyde. He could taste it on his tongue, the pungent ammonia scent that reminded him of his mother's cancer. On his right, a medical cabinet with extra scalpel blades, autopsy saws, and a handheld bone dust vacuum stood next to a garment rack filled with mothballed suits and sequined dresses. Clothes he stored for his elderly customers who already knew what they wanted to be buried in. Zig beelined for the back wall, to an old oak desk covered nearly to the ceiling with cardboard boxes. Overflow storage for cremation urns that came in every size and shape, including football urns, Harley-Davidson motorcycle engine urns, and even old leather book urns, complete with an engravable spine for your loved one's name. Come on. Where the hell are you? Zig muttered, feverishly pulling open all the drawers of the desk until... Gotcha. From the top right drawer, Zig pulled out what looked like a clear straw with a miniature spoon at the end of it. The mortician tool for transferring a loved one's ashes into small containers, like jewelry or lockets. The tube was made of industrial plastic, but since it functioned as a funnel... Roddy... Pull the gauze, Zig shouted, grabbing one more item from the drawer and racing back to the sanctuary. Turning the corner, Zig scanned the room, the redheads, Seabass, and the woman. In the chaos, both were gone. In the back of the sanctuary, there was a thick trail of blood across the carpet. She must have dragged Seabass out of here. Roddy had done a number on him, and he was too big to carry. Zig was relieved. One less disaster to deal with. At the front of the sanctuary, Roddy was hunched over Andy. In the back of Roddy's waistband, his pistol peeked out under his shirt. The .45 with the silencer. Zig barely noticed. He was too busy staring at Andy, who wasn't moving. Mr. Zig, it's bad. He's not- Stop talking, Zig shouted, dropping to his knees. From Andy's neck, Zig peeled away the layers of blood-drenched foam himself, revealing- Oh, God. Andy's face was gray, his breathing down to a ragged gasp. The worst part was his throat, a slit shaped like a gruesome smile. Red air bubbles gurgled from the wound, rising and falling with each shallow breath. Zig had been around enough bodies to know what came next. The bubbles, Roddy began. It means blood's pouring into his lungs. If you don't stop that, he didn't have to finish the sentence. In overdone TV movies, scrambling EMTs stab makeshift tracheostomy tubes made from hollowed-out pen barrels into a patient's throat to kickstart breathing. The reality wasn't nearly as easy. to get to the actual trachea.
Have you ever done this before, Mr. Zig?
Zig shot him a look. He didn't have a choice. Poking his thumb and pointer finger into the wound, Zig spread his fingers like he was enlarging a photo. The slit in Andy's throat widened like an open mouth. It was the only way to find.
There. The whiteness of the windpipe itself.
Feeling around with his fingers, Zig spread aside the muscles and fatty tissue to get to the windpipe. It was stiff to the touch, covered in ridges. From there, he simply followed the tiny red bubbles to a small notch. That's what he was looking for. The cut in the trachea. With his other hand, Zig slid the plastic cremation funnel into the slit of Andy's neck. It took Zig a moment to realize he was still holding his own breath. Over the years, he'd removed hundreds of stents from the windpipes of fallen soldiers. This was just the opposite of that, he told himself, almost believing it. The bubbles were his guide. Zig slid the tip of the funnel along Andy's windpipe, carefully aiming the tiny spoon until he held his breath again as it notched into the actual cut. That's the spot. The tip of the funnel was at the right entry point. Now came the hard part, getting it in. Zig tightened his grip on the funnel, trying to ignore the beads of sweat that he could taste on his top lip.
Mr. Zig, if you push too hard, you can rupture his...
Roddy, I will physically take your head off your body if you utter another syllable. Roddy went silent. Zig took another breath, licking the sweat from his lip. Gripping the plastic funnel like a screwdriver, he notched the funnel into the windpipe. With a quick twist, Zig gave it a quarter turn clockwise, then twisted it back again. Twist and twist it back, over and over, carefully trying to wedge it in just... There was a muted burst of air, like Andy belched, followed by a hiss. Drops of condensation appeared inside the plastic funnel. Air. Andy was getting air.
That's Mr. Zig. He's breathing.
Determined to keep it that way, Zig let go of the windpipe with one hand, then reached into his pocket and pulled out the one other item he'd taken from the desk. Every mortician's secret weapon. A tube of skin glue. Grabbing a flap of skin at Andy's throat, Zig squeezed it around the neck of the funnel and slathered it with skin glue. The glue turned pink from all the blood, but so far it was staying shut. Now to deal with the wound itself. Feverishly working left to right like he was sealing a Ziploc bag, Zig pinched Andy's skin shut and added more glue, then another pinch of skin, then another gob of glue. Inch by inch, he worked his way across Andy's throat, squeezing it so tight and adding so much glue that a few times his own fingers were stuck together. In the end, it left a bubbly pink scab across Andy's throat, the plastic tubes sticking up like a flagpole. But the bleeding... Zig gave it a moment, watching the skin stretch and pucker with the rise and fall of Andy's chest. He waited for more blood to seep through, but instead...
Done. Stopped.
Andy's eyes blinked awake. He looked around, panicking, still in shock, but the color was already back in his face.
I gotta be honest, Mr. Zig. I didn't think it would work, Roddy said. But you... Did you know they would be here, Roddy?
Roddy turned, confused. Zig was still on his knees, breathing heavily, trying to catch his breath. There was so much blood caked along his fingers. Zig scratched an itch on his nose with his forearm.
Did you know? Zig repeated, refusing to look at him. I don't understand. The redheads.
Seabass and his sister wife, or whatever the hell she is, Zig said, his voice low, simmering with anger as he motioned to the back of the empty sanctuary. In the distance was the faint wail of a siren, an ambulance, still a few blocks away. We would have been dead. They would have killed us, but for you swooping in and saving our asses. The timing was remarkable, Zig explained. So answer my question, Roddy. Did you know those redheads would be here?
Roddy cocked his head, like Zig was speaking Chinese. How could I possibly know that?
Zig turned, finally making eye contact, the siren growing louder. Then why'd you come here, Roddy?
The guy.
I found the guy. From the back of the painting, Roddy explained. Elijah King. The third guy from Mint and Nola's original mission. I spoke to him and he said he's willing to talk to us.
59. Zig needed this shower, and not just to get rid of the blood. He needed the quiet, the few minutes of solitude that came with standing naked, swallowed by the steam in the small bathroom just off the funeral home's embalming area. The water was too hot, tiny needles on his skin, but he didn't adjust it. Better to feel something, to feel anything. Zig lifted his chin, letting the spray hit him in the face. Most of the blood came off easily, antiseptic soap sending reddish-pink suds coiling like snakes down his arms and legs. The smell was the harder part. In the corner of the shower, Zig picked up a gallon jug of Clorox. Pouring the bleach onto his hand, he used a nail brush to scrub away the stubborn blood under each fingernail, same as cleaning a corpse. According to the cops and the EMTs, Zig's makeshift tracheostomy had saved Andy's life. It didn't make Zig feel any better. What happened today? What they did to Andy? Zig closed his eyes, unable to stop seeing it. The redhead with the saw. She slit Andy's throat. And for what? Something called Black House, whatever the hell that was. According to the redhead, it was a location online, a place where people want to talk, privately. Zig thought about that. If Mint was one of the people using Black House, who was he talking to? And what were they talking about? Zig was still scrubbing so hard with the nail brush, he didn't even realize he'd opened a hairline cut underneath his own thumbnail. It burned from the bleach. Zig barely flinched, thinking he deserved it. Half an hour ago, when the EMTs first arrived at the funeral home, Roddy flashed his badge. Zig knew it was a good thing, a way to stay in control. But it was time to admit, since the moment this started, Zig hadn't been in control. That needed to change. Especially with... Tap, tap. A knock on the bathroom door. Roddy, I'll be out in a sec, Zig called. The door opened with a click. Roddy, I swear, if you're standing there with a knife like Psycho... A hard yank sent the shower curtain sliding sideways. Zig spun around, naked, surprised to see a woman. She had silver hair with a black streak, and dark eyes with flecks of gold, just like her brother. Nola. He bent forward, trying to cover himself with his hands. Nola grabbed a nearby towel, tossing it at Zig. He was so focused on her, it hit him in the chest and fell to the floor. Sorry. Let me just... Zig reached down, picked up the towel, and quickly covered his waist. What the hell are you... The Reds, Mr. Zigarowski. Tell me what you know about the Reds. 60. What are you doing here? Zig challenged. Nola held a finger to her lips. Be quiet. She'd been hoping to avoid this moment, but she didn't have a choice. To her surprise, as Zig stood there in the silence, he was calm, scrambling just slightly as he wrapped the towel around his waist. Zig saw himself as a tough man, the kind of guy who asked hard questions and could deal with hard situations. For decades, that was his job. When the families of fallen soldiers came to Dover, he'd grant them his strength, giving them his last reserve so they could lean on him in that moment when they felt abandoned by every belief they once thought would never leave them. As Nola knew, that's where Zig found his self-worth. It's how he felt less alone and less guilty for his role in his daughter's death, by giving to others the one thing he'd never have. Closure. Yet right now, as Zig stood there with a towel at his waist in the still-running shower, Nola couldn't help but notice that even with the confusion on his face, there was also a nervous grin. Of course there was. Nola shook her head. It's what Zig always did when he saw her, seizing on some decade-old familiarity and acting as if she and he were friends, or even acquaintances.
It's good to see you,
Zig finally whispered, going to shut off the shower.
Keep it on,
Nola warned. She locked the door. They needed privacy.
I take it the cops are still outside. You avoiding them or your brother?
Zig asked, his voice still low. Nola didn't answer, glancing around the small 1980s bathroom, complete with a salmon-colored backsplash and a teal toilet. There were cracks in both the backsplash and floor tiles. Easily repairable, but ignored. It was the same with this Dairy Queen-turned-funeral home. And really, she realized, the same with Zig. Once something happy. But now, over time, hollowed out from spending so much time around death. You look tired, Zig added. He looked worse. The lines in his face were deeper than Nola remembered, his skin papery. As he stood there on the small ledge of the still-running shower, what stuck out most was the way his eyebrows now dominated his face. They were overgrown, as was a clump of hairs along his ears. No one to pluck them for, or to do it for him. Nola's first thought was that he'd aged in the past 2 years, but that was quickly replaced by what felt like a rift in her brain, that she was still remembering Zig from when she was 12 years old, back in Girl Scouts. Don't let him take you back there. Mongol, Faber, Stettler, Ticonderoga. Opposite the sink, she pushed aside a set of ratty curtains, revealing a four-pane window. Bigger than she thought. Crusted paint chips along the far ends of the sill. Good. Not painted shut. Anyone comes, that's the way out.
Nola, if you need to sit down.
He pointed to the closed toilet, a pinwheel of steam twirling in the wake of his motion.
I'm fine, she insisted, hating that concern in his voice, even as she caught herself in the slowly fogging mirror.
Zig was right. She did look tired, exhausted even, dark bags under her eyes. Her hair was greasy, stray strands pointing at different angles. From her earliest army days, Nola was a street fighter put into a uniform. They taught her to be focused and in control. Now, the way she stood there, swaying slightly, she felt harried, off balance. She didn't like it.
Tell me about the Reds, Nola insisted.
The who?
The ones who attacked you. The Red Heads. They call themselves the Reds.
That's a terrible name, Zig said, opening the window on his left as the steam was quickly sucked toward the crack.
The big one? The guy? I think his name was...
He paused, Nola watching to see if his tongue touched his incisor, which Zig did when he was lying.
She called him Seabass.
I'm guessing Sebastian?
True.
The woman is Reagan, Nola replied. Both were discharged years ago for selling stolen military gear on eBay. I need to know what they said, Mr. Zigarowski. Anything that they might have...
Black House.
They wanted to know what I knew about Black House.
And?
Truthfully, I was just trying to stall, or at least fish for info. She said... Black House. She called it an online meeting place.
Nola made a face. She only told you because she was planning to kill you.
I know that. You think I'm a moron,
Mr. Zigarowski? You don't want to know what I think.
Then tell me, he growled with a look she'd never seen before. Because even when I put aside the fact that two sociopath redheads probably still want me dead, and that's a hard thing to put aside, your insults and the whole lone wolf act are starting to wear thin. You obviously came here for a reason, Nola. I'd like to hear it.
In truth, she was surprised to see him this pissed. She didn't think he had it in him. But as Nola knew since she was little, everyone has it in them.
You've obviously had a hard day. No, this is way beyond hard day.
My friend, Andy, He. Right now, he's in the back of an ambulance, racing to the hospital. That's his blood. Look!
Reaching inside the shower, he grabbed the soap, which was streaked with dark red stripes.
That's his blood!
Mr. Zagorowski, if you don't lower your voice...
Then what? You'll treat me like you already treat me? I get that you don't like me, Nola. And I know it physically kills you when someone actually offers you help. But let me give you one unarguable fact.
The only reason you're standing in this tiny bathroom is because there's someone out there right now who is scaring the shit out of you. Maybe it's the cops, or the Reds, or...
Oh, let's just be honest for once. We know it's your brother.
You know nothing about him.
I don't need to. The facts are obvious. Someone put a bullet in the head of your friend Archie Mint. And because you and Mint had a relationship,
we didn't have a relationship.
Because he was your commander. Because you feel like you owe him something. Because back in the day, he bought you a paint set that you used to write Rosebud on your sled.
Whatever the damn reason is, Nola, you've been frantically searching for his killer. But in your usual scorched earth approach, the only person in this entire damn mess who you absolutely know is on your side is me. I know why you're trying to help Mr. Zagorowski, and it has nothing to do with concern for me.
What are you talking about?
Nola stood there, watching him grip the shower curtain, nearly pulling the rod down with it.
Maggie, you think this is just about Maggie?
Zig challenged, referring to his daughter.
That I've put my life on the line. Me digging into this case. That it's just about the fact you two were in Girl Scouts? And you think I'm the narcissist here?
At Mint's funeral, did you even see his wife?
What about his kids, whose lives are now in ruin? The son who couldn't stop sobbing, and his daughter,
her name is Violet. I know her damn name. I put her baseball glove in her father's coffin.
Lower your voice.
Then open your ears, he whispered. I wouldn't be on this case if it weren't for you, but they're the ones who deserve our attention.
Their father was murdered. People are still being murdered, and as far as I can tell, your name is on that same target list.
Nola started to turn. Behind her, outside the bathroom, there was a noise. Someone was,
Mr. Zig, we should get going, Roddy called, hitting the door with a loud knock.
Nola froze. So did Zig. A swirl of steam twirled between them from the still-running shower.
Almost done, Roddy.
Sounds great,
Zig called back, his tongue touching his incisor. Definitely a lie.
I'm out front when you're ready, Roddy replied.
Seconds later, a door slammed. Then another, Roddy leaving the embalming room and heading back to the main sanctuary. Taking no chances, Nola reached into the shower and turned on an old Sharper Image radio that hung from the shower nozzle and once seemed like it was from the future. Prince started singing about calling up a shrink in Beverly Hills. Doctor, everything'll be all right.
Nola, if you just accept some help,
stop talking, she said. I found his account.
On Black House, she explained.
I know who killed Colonel Mint.